Strong, and welcome to the ESVS podcast. Today, we will focus on the superficial femoral artery, the SFA. Peripheral endovascular treatment has developed and increased exponentially. It has become the mainstream in the SFA, first choice in isolated SFA severe disease, or even occlusion with patent popliteal artery, displacing the traditional above-knee femoral popliteal bypass. While historically guidelines have recommended endovascular treatment for task A and B lesions, and open surgical bypass was the gold standard for task C and D lesions, practice has pivoted towards endovascular treatment of task C and D SFA lesions, as endovascular technology has been improving. So much so that in this podcast, we are going to explore what room remains for this above-knee fempop bypass, or if it has become fully endovascular territory. To explore this topic, I am privileged to present our two guests today, Dr. Michel Bosier, Senior Vascular and Endovascular Consultant at the University Hospital in Bern, Switzerland, and Dr. Willemien van der Water, Senior Vascular and Endovascular Consultant at the Maastricht University Hospitals, Netherlands. Thank you both for taking the time to explore this topic with us today.
Hi, happy to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Hi, it's good to be here. Thanks a lot.
Dr. Bosier, in occluded or extensively and severely diseased SFA, what is your current practice and why? What is your go-to?
So my current practice nowadays is to perform a recanalization if it's a long occlusion from crossover. If I have a stump of at least 5-7 centimeters, I go perform an antegrade approach. I always prep the patient so that I have a possibility to also perform a retrograde puncture below the knee or P1 or P3 segment. I try to recanalize with an 018 wire and support catheter, and then perform POBA. And when I see a flow-limiting dissection directly after POBA, I would put in a drug-eluting stent. If I see no flow-limiting dissection, good result of POBA, I would use a DCB. Of course, when we have extremely calcified lesions, we need another kind of vessel prep. And in my opinion, this would be the use of technologies like lithotripsy or orbital atherectomy combined with drug-coated balloons or drug-eluting stents.
Thank you. And yours, Dr. van der Water, what is your take in that scenario? And has your practice changed over the years?
I think what I would like to underline is that we first have to decide whether there is an indication phase of treatment at all, because I think it's of great importance and we'll discuss it later on as well. But it's often undervalued. And in case of claudication, I'd make sure to optimize your cardiovascular risk management and to have your supervised exercise therapy program. And in the Netherlands, we have the advantage that we have a high adherence to SET because invasive treatment is only reimbursed after supervised exercise therapy. And we have a structured standardized referral to the physiotherapist. And after cardiovascular risk management exercise therapy, I think one of the most important assessments is whether I burn any bridges. As patency of both open and endo procedures may not be sufficient to accommodate our younger patients in the lung. So in other words, practically, I try to avoid endovascular treatment in which I'm losing suprapopliteal landing zone for a future bypass. And that might mean to sometimes to stop along the procedure or to pursue a retrograde recanalization, as Michel already mentioned as well. And in some cases, I would opt for a primary bypass as a treatment. And if you ask me about things that have changed, I think I'm more aware of this conservative management and more endorsed to follow that stepwise approach. And what also changed is that I'm not thinking as lightly about endovascular procedures as I might have done in the past. I don't think that if it doesn't help, it doesn't hurt.
So I think one of the things we were trying to get at with this question is whether in the past you would have been more open to an above-knee bypass that now would be done by endovascular techniques because they're better than maybe 10 years ago. But it sounds like what you're saying is no.
Yes, actually, recently, I'm becoming more enthusiastic about the surgical option again. So it might be even the odds too soon to say it's the other way around because we have a lot of endovascular first. But I think when I was educated, I was really stimulated and educated to have endo first for every patient. And now I'm more critical for this intervention.
Thank you for that. And we're going to get into the details also of some of the literature that we have available to us. Do you, off the bat right there, Dr. Bosier, do you have any comment you'd like to make?
I have a different opinion.
Yes.
I fully agree, of course, with walking exercise, and this is what we're doing also in Bern. First, having those patients on a walking exercise, and then after reevaluation, and they really are not happy with the quality of life that they have achieved with maybe improvement of 10 meters in during the walking distance. We give them endovascular treatment because we know from different trials that we're going to discuss also here that endo first strategy for SFA is a good strategy with equal patency results as for bypass surgery as well.
Let's analyze the results of endovascular treatment and above-knee fempop bypass regarding durability and intervention, first looking at open surgery. Above-knee bypass studies are relatively limited, and reported primary patency rates vary widely, between 60 and 90% at 1 year and between 58 and 83% at 2 years. Some studies reporting little difference between venous bypass outcomes and prosthetic bypass outcomes. A recent systematic review published in February of this year in Vascular by Vossen and Co. compared venous bypass prosthetic above-knee bypasses for intermittent claudication. They meta-analyzed data from 6 studies and 524 patients reporting average patency rates at 1 year of 88% for venous graft versus 76% for prosthetic and 5 year patency rates of 81% versus 68%. However, these differences in favor of venous grafts were not initially statistically significantly different until follow-up reached over 3 years. A systematic review from the Centre Hospitalier de Lille published in September of last year in the Journal of Endovascular Therapy looked specifically at endovascular treatment of long femoropopliteal lesions greater than 150 millimeters, task C or D. They meta-analyzed data from 44 papers with 5,282 treated limbs. Primary patencies at 1 year were 68% for bare metal stent, 67% for covered stents, and 74% for drug-eluting stents, and 83% for drug-coated balloons. Dr. Bouzier, you are the first author of the ZILVERPASS study published in July 2023 in the Journal of Cardiovascular and Interventional Radiology, which prospectively compares 5 year patency rates and reintervention rates of the ZILVER PTX stent versus prosthetic above-knee fempop bypass. Can you summarize for our listeners the main findings of the study?
Yes, so we randomized 220 patients in a non-inferiority design, one-to-one randomized controlled trial to drug-eluted stent, silver PTX, and a prosthetic bypass. The major findings would be that there was a significant freedom from complication rate at 30 days in favor of the endovascular technology compared to bypass. And what we now published, the 5 year results, and what this is what we saw also at 1 year and at 3 years, was that there was no difference regarding to patency. So after 5 years, we had a patency rate of 49% for the endovascular technology versus 40.7% for the bypass surgery. We had a freedom from TLR, which was quite high after 5 years, of 63.8%. For endo group versus 52.8% in the bypass group, and also freedom from mortality of 69% and 71% for endo and bypass group. Overall, these 5 years did not reach any statistical significance, so meaning we have a non-inferiority of silver PTX compared to the bypass group. We also had a freedom from amputation rate at 5 years from almost 95% in both groups after 5 years, so these were excellent results. There were slightly more patients with CLTI in the bypass group compared to claudicants, despite the randomization. So we did a multivariate analysis to see if we could see a difference there, but we couldn't see any difference between the CLTI group and the claudicant group in both arms and also between each other.
Thank you. The paper mentions that while there was no crossover after randomization, lesions must have been successfully crossed intraoperatively before enrollment in the endovascular arm of the study was considered complete. At the same time, you report 94.5% of lesions to have been complete occlusions. What proportion of patients achieved successful endovascular passage, and how many were discarded from entering to the final study because of unsuccessful passage? Also, can you tell us about the adjunctive technology that might have been necessary to cross the occlusions, like atherectomy or lithotripsy? Do we have any data on that?
As you mentioned, we have no crossover. So from the data that we got and we could analyze, see that all lesions could be crossed. Re-entry devices were not allowed, but retrograde punctures were allowed. We did not put this in the analysis, so we don't know how many patients needed retrograde puncture. However, regards to vessel prep tools, except for POBA, nothing else was allowed. So no atherectomy was allowed. Back in the days, there was also no lithotripsy available. But again, this was also not allowed. So only POBA and then straight going into with the drug-eluting stents.
So in the SILVER-PASS study, 65% of the 220 enrolled patients had intermittent claudication and 27% CLTI. Dr. Van der Water, you have recently co-authored the 2024 ESVS guidelines, Asymptomatic Lower Limb Peripheral Arterial Disease and Intermittent Claudication. Recommendation 63 states that, and I quote, for patients with disabling intermittent claudication due to femoropopliteal steno-occlusive disease, a careful selection for revascularization is recommended, where the treatment indication is weighed against the degree of disability, results of non-invasive therapies, concomitant comorbidities, procedural risks, and expected procedural patency, due to remaining uncertainty about the sustained clinical benefits and risks. So invasive treatment should be used fairly exceptionally in claudication. Can you comment on this?
Yeah, thanks. That's indeed what we conclude in the guideline. And there's been different reasons that contributed to this somewhat conservative approach. One of it is that limb prognosis in claudication is typically benign, at least in terms of limb threat. So in a prospective study examining the natural history of patients with claudication, the incidence of progression to chronic limb-threatening ischemia was about 1% in 5 years. And in this regard, supervised exercise therapy and cardiovascular risk management have been shown to be cost-effective and reduce the need for invasive procedures. Of course, as we discussed already, it might not be available everywhere or it might not be reimbursed, but I don't think this is an argument to proceed directly to revascularization. Rather, efforts should be directed towards addressing and eliminating the barriers that hinder successful implementation of a set program. The long-term patency of invasive procedures in claudication is rather moderate, while patients have quite a remaining life expectancy. So it's really about quality of life. And none of the commonly available treatment methods, but that also includes supervised exercise therapy, I have to say, translate to a sustained patient benefit in the long term. So if you really have more than 2 to 5 years of follow-up, the long-term value of any treatment, including revascularization, there's room for improvement. Lastly, interventions might lead to interventions due to complications, occlusion or reocclusion of recanalized vessels. So therefore, I think it's reasonable to postpone or reserve invasive treatment for those who are not responding to cardiovascular risk management and supervised exercise therapy. It's not that you can't do it, absolutely not. I think you should be aware of the stepwise approach.
Thank you. Let's go back to the conclusion of the SILVER-PASS paper. The paper provides evidence for non-inferiority of the SILVER-PTX stent compared to prosthetic above the knee bypass. And this evidence is also quoted in your new guidelines, and recommendation 69 advocates for individualized or patient-tailored decision-making. So I quote, for patients with disabling intermittent claudication with long and heavily calcified femoropopliteal occlusions undergoing revascularization, so the patients we've already decided we're going to be treating them, the revascularization strategy should be individualized and include specific patient and lesion characteristics, center interventionist experience, device availability, and the presence or absence of a suitable venous conduit. Dr. Van der Water, how are we to interpret this? Are you actually confirming that there is a non-inferiority for endovascular approach with this recommendation? Does this recommendation agree with the conclusion?
First of all, I do think the results of the SILVER-PASS study are impressive. And I also think they underline the patency of the treatment of severely diseased fempop segment. With a 5-year patency, correct me if I'm wrong, Michelle, about 40 to 50%. As you already mentioned, there was a little imbalance in treatment arms, including a higher proportion of CLTI patients and a bit higher risk profiles in the surgical bypass arm. But nevertheless, the subgroup analysis did not indicate any difference. The reasons for using a prosthetic bypass in a trial are mentioned and well thought of, but this would not be my preferred strategy in bypass surgery because I would always check for a suitable vein as a conduit. And I think that's also shown by a recent meta-analysis of Boston et al. And recent sub-analysis of the best CLI trial. To answer your question, I would not generalize that any endo treatment is non-inferior to any bypass. But I do agree that both options may be the best for your patient. Treating a fempop lesion is not a cookbook recipe. So it remains a personalized approach based on patient characteristics, lesions characteristics, and the available expertise. And both can be the best for your patient. Absolutely.
Thank you for your take on that. You mentioned best CLI. Let's talk about best CLI for a moment. The best endovascular versus best surgical therapy for patients with critical limb ischemia, New England Journal of Medicine publication of 2022. Best CLI looks at CLTI specifically and reports evidence that patients with an adequate great saphenous vein benefit from venous bypass most, while those without a majority of about 80%, by the way, showed no significant differences in outcomes between prosthetic bypass and endovascular treatment. While best CLI included all infrainguinal PAD, the number of above-knee bypasses reported within the trial was 162, accounting for 18% of patients treated surgically overall. The number of endovascular treatments targeting the SFA was 620, accounting for 68% of patients treated endovascularly overall. Best CLI subgroup analysis reports 33% of patients in cohort 1 and 37% in cohort 2 had no infrapopliteal disease. So they are the SFA group that we are talking about in this podcast. In cohort 1, those that have a great saphenous vein, within this group, rate of major adverse limb event or death from any cause was statistically different between the bypass group, 38%, versus the endovascular group, 54%. Hazard ratio 0.65, 95% confidence interval 0.5 to 0.68. Surprisingly, this difference is actually smaller in the subgroup with infrapopliteal disease, 45% in the bypass group and 59% in the endovascular group. Hazard ratio 0.7, confidence interval 0.58 to 0.83. In line with the overall results of the study, cohort 2, so those with no adequate great saphenous vein, showed less of a difference with no statistical significance. 37% had no infrapopliteal disease, as we mentioned. Major adverse limb event or death was 43% in the surgical group and 42% in the endovascular group with no statistical significance. This would suggest that the importance of having a great saphenous vein and using it is not to be underestimated, even in patients with no infrapopliteal disease. In the Zilver Pass paper, you explain in the study design that prosthetic bypasses were chosen deliberately as the control arm. While best CLI data shows venous grafts to have the best results, standard of care in several participating medical facilities of the Zilver Pass study was prosthetic and not venous bypass, choosing to spare the GSV for potential distal bypassing in the future. Do you think this is a founded or unfounded practice? Is it really justified to spare the GSV for future bypassing, in your opinion? The question stands to both of you.
First of all, when I have a long SFA popliteal occlusions and we need a P3 segment attachment and we have a patient with a decent vein with critical limb ischemia, I will go for venous bypass 100%. I had a look at the data which was out there before best CLI, and there was actually no trial that was designed for comparison prosthetic versus vein that has shown a robust evidence for superiority of vein bypass, unfortunately. Yeah. Even the meta-analysis you mentioned of Vossen also highlighted the lack of high-quality evidence. So I think we should do better there. Yeah. For above-the-knee lesions, as I mentioned before, I strongly believe in endo-first strategy in, as you have also mentioned, centers with procedural knowledge, with have all the right tools to know how to do a retrograde cussing, cart, reverse cart, whatever technique there is out there, to avoid complications. But as mentioned before, if I see a long occlusion, patient has a good vein, of course, vein bypass is my way to go. But as we've seen also in best CLTI, 25% doesn't have a suitable vein. And as soon as you start making composite grafts or PTFE grafts, the results are, even in these long occlusions, going all the way down below the knee, are the same for endo versus bypass.
Dr. Van der Vaart, what's your opinion on the great saphenous vein and keeping it for a potential distal bypass in the future? Do you think this is a founded or unfounded practice, in your opinion?
In light, we discussed that the long-term patency of invasive procedures in claudication is rather moderate. It is smart to think ahead and not to burn any bridges for the future. So it may be a reasonable consideration. However, it should not be noticed that there is an increased risk of infection in a redo groin, especially when it also contains an occluded PTV bypass. So personally, I'm a big fan of venous option. Rather go for contralateral great saphenous vein or even sliced vein.
So when we're also talking about the vein versus the prosthesis or endovascular options, Dr. Bozzi, how much do you think operating time also plays a role into decision-making? Because presumably, bypassing is pretty by the book or standardized, and long occlusive lesions might take a long time to achieve success. Do you have any information on the time it takes to endovascularly cross an SFA occlusion?
So we ask every physician, they will all lie and say, just half an hour. So I think this is why we analyzed it also in the Silver Pass trial. And what we saw was that the endovascular procedure took an average of 1 hour. and the bypass took an average of 2 hours, which of course reached a statistical significant difference. So not only the longitude of the intervention for the patient, but also the fact that you can do the endovascular treatment in local anesthesia plays a big advantage, in my opinion.
Totally agree. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's talk about the complication rates for a little bit. Complication rates for open and endovascular treatment of the SFA, does this play a big role in your decision making?
It does. I mean, it has to be, you know, and you need to calculate also the 30-day morbidity ratios in your decision-making. We all agree, I think, endovascular, what cases are, puncture site complications, hematoma, false aneurysms. That's why I always suggest all my colleagues, all my fellows to perform ultrasound-guided puncture. You can have dissections, more rarely rupture or peripheral embolization. So again, you need to know how to tackle those complications. Early recoil, so put in a stent or have a control after 10 minutes or 15 minutes to see if you have an early recoil. And with open surgery, we all know these patients with wound healing disorders, especially in the groin, wound infections, lymphedema, and so on and so on. If I go back to the Silverpass trial, I think we had a few puncture site complications, no embolization, and the majority of complications in the open surgery group were infections, lymphedema, and of course, thrombosis and occlusions.
Yeah. I think I agree with you, Michelle. What I would like to add for the endovascular procedure, so we always not only use ultrasound guided access, but also closure. So if we close with an angioseal, for example, we do it ultrasound guided as well to reduce the risk of occlusion at puncture sites. And I always use a heparin drip system on the sheath with any antegrade procedure in the hope to reduce the risk of thromboembolization from thrombus adhering to the sheath. For surgical procedures, we use negative wound dressings in the groins in a standard fashion in order to reduce the risk of postoperative wound infection. And I think especially in the groin, that could be devastating if it appears. So that is a very serious complication indeed.
This is something we only use in obese patients, the negative wound pressure. We didn't see any benefit in normal built patients without any risk of infections.
Our experience is good, but that's just a single center experience, of course. Sometimes, well, I have asked myself, and these data are not available, unfortunately, that just leaving the wound untouched for a week, because that's what you do with a negative pressure bandage, might have an effect on postoperative wound infection already, regardless of the negative pressure.
What about drainage? There are some pro-drainage for some physicians who stopped using drainage because they think, oh, it's a risk for infection.
A standard to leave a drain in the groin? Never do it, no. But that would be for seroma prevention then, supposedly?
Seroma prevention.
Or a hematoma? No. I do close in many layers, at least 4 or 5 layers to close the wound and then the negative pressure. So I think to reduce dead space, I'd rather go for a multiple layer closure than to leave a drain. What do you do?
We still routinely use a drain.
Ah, nice.
Take it out after 2 days. If we see that the volume that's coming out is less than 60 cc's.
Is there a lot of patients with a lot of drainage then? Or?
Oh, the majority can be taken out within 24 or 48 hours.
Yeah.
So 90%, and it's maybe 10%, which requires a day further, and then we see that it stops.
Those are interesting insights. To wrap up this discussion, we will mention the findings of the BASIL 3 trial, still unpublished, but presented in the Charing Cross meeting in April. BASIL 3 compares different endovascular treatments for femoral popliteal disease causing CLTI. The primary endpoint is amputation-free survival in line with previous BASIL studies. 481 patients between 216 and 21 were randomized to angioplasty with or without bare metal stent, drug-coating balloon with or without bare metal stent, and thirdly, drug-eluting stent. In the intention to treat analysis, amputation-free survival was achieved in 34% of the HOBA group, 40% of the drug-coating group, and 42% of the drug-eluting stent group. However, these differences were not found to be statistically significant. Comparing HOBA to DCB had a HR and hazard ratio of 0.84, 7.5% confidence interval crossing 1, while comparing POBA to drug-eluting state gave a hazard ratio of 0.83 with a confidence interval again crossing 1. Similar trends were reported in secondary outcomes, 7-year survival rates, major amputation rates, major adverse limb events, and lastly, major adverse cardiovascular events.
So small differences that tend toward benefits for drug-eluting devices. However, once again, these differences were not found to be statistically significant, with hazard ratio calculations showing confidence intervals that crossed one each time. Is there anything that you would like to comment about this, that there doesn't seem to be a big difference between using the different endovascular devices in the initial results of Basal 3?
Well, I think there are some issues with Basal 3. I think one of my major concern is the primary endpoint that was chosen being amputation-free survival, because I don't think you will see the drug effect happening here in this trial, because I don't know how many reinterventions you had. You're treating the same patient group, so mortality is the same. And I think the drug effect would be less in reinterventions, and then, of course, in the future, less amputations. In this trial, I believe above the knee treat was performed, so we don't know what the below the knee anatomy looked like. Was there impaired outflow in the CLTI group or anything? What surprises me the most in this trial is that it took over 6 years. They only randomized 481 patients. So that's 247 months, two patients per month in 35 centers that randomized patients. Yeah. Of course, you can have the COVID impact. You have the Katsanos impact, which could play the role here. I don't know, you know. But these are some concerns that I had whilst, you know, we're still waiting the publication. So we can't say a lot at this moment, of course.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the endpoint has been discussed thoroughly since the beginning of the trial, but also at Charing Cross again, to establish the efficacy of these drug-eluting devices. It might not be the ideal endpoint. It is a relevant endpoint, of course, for patients in your clinical practice, but for efficacy of this kind of devices, it might not be the optimal one.
It's difficult to choose the correct endpoint to show endovascular devices that are in steps improving in their results, but not taking huge leaps. It will be difficult to show these incremental changes, isn't it?
It is. I think it's more easy to have an endpoint for CLTI patients, and they will have more of these endpoints as well. And they reach these endpoints soon, and it's more relevant in these patients than in claudicants, for example. And next to choosing appropriate endpoint, it remains a challenge to have homogeneous treatment groups. As Michelle already said, if you have 35 centers including for a long period of time, there will not be that many inclusions per center, and probably there will be more intervention lists per center. So it's difficult to obtain a homogeneous result. In that light, a surgical bypass is, of course, there are different techniques, but it's less subject to heterogeneity.
It would be good to see why and how many patients were excluded from the trial and what kind of treatment they got. I think regarding the outcome, I mean, if you're a patient, you want to have a treatment and you don't want to have to necessarily come back every year to have a reintervention, yeah? As we've seen, I mean, currently doing another above-the-knee POBA versus DCB trial, and within 1 year, I've seen the majority of the patients we were treated with POBA coming back for a reintervention, yeah? And I don't see this in the DCB group. And all the other trials for those simple lesions that we rarely see nowadays showed a better freedom from clinical-driven TLR in the DCB group. So I strongly believe that drug technology, being it on a balloon, being it on a stent, has a better outcome in terms to TLR, patency, and so on and so on. I think in the cost analysis, that's maybe, again, we haven't seen the paper, that could be the conclusion there, that having less reinterventions, being it making it more cost-effective, you know?
So as you mentioned, I'll read out the economic analysis from Basal 3 for our listeners. So among other findings, drug-eluting stents were less costly by about £700 compared with POBA and resulted in an additional QALY of 0.048. The probability of a drug-eluting stent strategy compared with a POBA being cost-effective was 76% at the current threshold and 64% if the threshold was £15,000. Do you have any comments on these results?
None other than the ones I made, because I don't know how the UK system works. The economic analysis for the Silver Pass trial, for the drug-eluting technology and the bypass, and we saw it was cheaper for the payer using a drug-eluting technology than the open bypass surgery. This was mainly because of the shorter hospital stay.
I think the healthcare system dictates partly if it's cost efficient. But what you are saying, Michelle, if you have a shorter hospital stay and less reinterventions, that makes sense in the option to make it more cost efficient. I'm really eagerly awaiting the results in publication to see the details here.
Thank you. So final conclusions, back to our original question. What room remains nowadays for an above-knee fempop bypass? Dr. Bozier, do you think the above-knee bypasses will disappear into the horizon as endovascular technology continues to move the dial?
Short answer, yes. Longer answer would be not necessarily, because we're doing a lot of cases here for PAD cases with SFA disease. The amount of FEMPOP1 bypass has reduced extremely. I think we're doing one or two per year. I don't know how it's in your hospital, Wilhelmine. How many?
It has been reduced. Bypass? Absolutely.
How about you, Dr. Van der Water? Do you imagine there will always be a space for above-knee bypasses, or should we expect the next round of guidelines to recommend an endovascular first approach in extensive femoral popliteal lesions, task C and D, as they do now for A and B?
Absolutely. I think there will be a role for above the knee bypass. The more endovascular experience we have, the more studies we perform, the more we also realize that no treatment is a holy grail in obtaining favorable long-term results. And we also realize it's not a free shot that you have. It's not that if it doesn't help, it doesn't hurt. So for the next guideline and in general, I'm convinced that patient selection is key to assess who's candidate for what type of revascularization. So both open and endovascular options will remain on the table.
Thank you both again for this interesting and timely discussion. It has been a pleasure learning from you.
Thank you, Laurence, for the excellent questions in organizing this podcast.
Thanks a lot for having us and having the discussion a bit pro and con. Very nice to be here.
And thank you to our listeners. Stay tuned for more ESVS podcasts to come soon. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.